cares?
Welcome to the How Not to Think podcast with my dog Jack in the background. We're having a little difficulty with him today, but please ignore him. A show is really about how we think and the default settings of the mind and things like binary thinking and problems like that. Today we have a very special program because we are in the middle of, or at some stage in the pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic, and we have a very illustrative story, or at least a story that's very relevant today. So I want to immediately welcome a friend of mine. In the interest of complete openness, I will say that I worked on her book with her in God's Waiting Room, and we'll get to that in a minute. But she is someone who has experienced at the front line what it is like to be a someone who has actually contracted a virus, a bit like the coronavirus is going on now in a pandemic. So welcome from Florida, Barbara Morello. Hey, Barb, how are you?
Hey, Howard. Thank you, first of all, for having me on your show this morning. And wow, I mean, there couldn't be a better time to talk about it because of all the fear going around with the virus.
Yes. And so let's get straight into the story. And for our written for the listeners, in 2009, there was a pandemic, the swine flu or H1N1, that emerged. Actually, wasn't it mostly in the South and South America? It came up from Mexico and started impacting Florida, where you were. So tell me what happened with you and what was going on at the time before you contracted this.
Well, I remember there was a lot of very nervous people, much like today. And any time that somebody had contracted the virus, especially the kids, they would shut the school down for a week and make sure it was okay to return. And I remember the cruise lines were nervous, but I'll tell you, the flu season really wound up again in the fall. And in November, actually, I even know the day I contracted it, which was the 3rd, because we had been with an individual who had come down from Canada who just got released from the hospital in Miami, because he thought he had it. And the problem was the testing with the CDC, a lot of times it would come back negative and they would have to retest for it to be a positive. So we spent the day with him in a car and he kept coughing and sneezing. And the next day, boy, oh boy, did I, I felt bad, and it was just right downhill from there. And then by the following weekend, I got to the hospital just in time because my organs were already in the process of shutting down. And I guess they call that hypoxic, where, yeah. And I remember I was struggling to breathe, but it's not like being short of breath, like if you've been running, but it's a kind of breath where you're just feeling like you're breathing, but you're not getting the oxygen in. So they intubated me initially. And I stayed in a coma on propofol for 4 days. And then they took me off the propofol and I did not come out of the coma. So I remained in a coma, well, all in all, for 2 weeks.
Now, when you contacted this via this gentleman who's visiting from Canada, when you started coughing and spluttering the next day, did you make the connection? Did you think you were infected or what?
No, but my husband was very concerned about me. And he said, honey, you need to go to the doctor. You need to get on Tamiflu. So I remember the day well because it was the day, was it Remembrance Day? You know, what is it? In Canada, it's called Remembrance Day, or was the 11th, and everybody's off school. So my son and I went to the doctor and he said, oh yeah, you just have bronchitis. And I said, well, how do you know it's bronchitis and it's not the other dreaded word? And he said, no, it's, you got, I said, but without testing, how do you know? And he said, oh, just, you know, here, take the Z-Pak and some other things. And well, that was probably the worst thing I could have done because the Z-Pak actually that's steroids, by the way, lowers your immunity. So then my body had a harder time to fight the infection.
Do you think that he did that because he didn't have any testing, or, you know, he was being overwhelmed, or just not a good decision? Do you have any idea of what that was about? You know, did he say, you know, I'd like to be able to test you, but I don't have staff or anything like that? Did he reference H1N1 at all? Do you recall?
No, it's hard to say, Howard. I don't know, really.
Okay. All right. So, and it took you a week, really, didn't it? Or what was it, 4 or 5 days before you went to the hospital? Fortunately, Mike, your husband, is a paramedic, and so perhaps was a bit more sensitive than other people might have been about this. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you go to the hospital, and very quickly it's downhill for you.
Yeah, very quickly. The doctor said that I made it in that window of organs shutting down, because if I wouldn't have gone when I did, I would have died. Because once the organs start shutting down, and by the way, there was severe damage sustained to all the organs because of how they did shut down. And so I was on full life support. So I was in a renal failure, heart failure, all the failures you can imagine that go when the organs start shutting down.
Yeah, and just for people to know that the swine flu pandemic, and it was ultimately called a pandemic, actually the infection rate was estimated between 11 and 21% of the world's population, which turns out to be, in terms of infections, 700 million to 1.4 billion people, somewhere in that range. A million people, give or take 300,000, in that range. So that's a lot of people. And the estimated number of deaths was anything from 150,000 worldwide to 575,000 people. So this was a major, major problem. Obviously, you didn't expect it to deteriorate that quickly. And here you are now and in the hospital, and before long, correct me if I'm wrong, were the ambulance called twice for you?
Yes, because the first time they were called, my vitals seemed stable. And they said, well, call us again if you start to decline. And of course, they recommend you go to the hospital anyway, but I just thought it was highly unnecessary, since if everything seems okay. But I had this strange feeling, Howard. I knew something wasn't right. And I thought, well, I have a funny feeling I will be going to the hospital, but I'm going to go in style. I'm going to jump in the shower and put some makeup on. So I got into the shower. And when I came out, I collapsed. And my son then called 911 again, and I was telling him, please don't, because I'm so humiliated. Plus, I'm on the floor with wet hair and I'm covered in a towel. Okay. So he calls, and now the second crew that comes, they're very good friends of my husband's. They all work together. And one of the guys said, no, you know, you're going. And they tested my blood sugar, and it was way over 300. And so there I was going with all my hair all over the place, no makeup, talk about vanity. It's like not the way you want to go to the hospital. But as soon as I got into the hospital, I kept throwing up and throwing up, and I hadn't eaten anything. So I guess that's when you're hypoxic, you start to throw up a lot. And then I guess I lost consciousness, because I don't remember anything after an hour. But obviously my body was still talking and acting, because everybody was telling me about the phone calls I was making that I have no memory of. And at this time, Mike had gone on a hunting trip, but he was so concerned, he wanted to cancel the trip and not go, because he had a strange feeling as well. So he was already on his way back. He was getting ready to fly back from Chicago. And by the time he got to the hospital, you know, he saw me all hooked up too on ventilators and life support. And, you know, he pretty much, the whole 5 weeks I was in the hospital, did not leave my side. But it was really touch and go in the beginning because they asked my sister to come down from Canada, who at the time was my trustee. And what, hon? My healthcare surrogate. And they thought, as my sister tells, I would be going home in a wooden box. They didn't think I was going to make it through the night.
Yeah. What, and let's stop just there and let's reflect on what you've said. How important these different interactions were and how seemingly these small things make a huge difference. One, the contact with the contractor or your friend who had it, who actually thought he had it. And hopefully if you were, you know, if that were today, if you thought you had it, you social distance, you don't go out. Okay.
Right.
So that's the first thing. Then you got it. Fortunately, you have a husband, Mike, who knows about these things and was pressing you even as you were sort of minimizing it. Then you go to a doctor who says it's really nothing to do with this, you know, as far as we know. That's what he said, and probably was not as helpful as he could be. Let's be diplomatic, okay? Mm-hmm. Then you get a first aid or EMS crew who are a bit concerned you, but tell you you're okay, you know, but call if you need us, yeah. Okay? Then you get a second crew who fortunately know you and therefore, or know Mike, and therefore are able to be a bit more upright and honest with you and say, you need to go to the hospital. Look at all those choice points where things could go wrong, could have been diverted either way, you know. You know, the guy who thinks he's got it, he stays home, you don't get it, right?
Yeah.
Or the doctor says we need to test you and you go into the hospital earlier, perhaps without the experience that we're about to hear, and putting you at death's door. And so on. So it's just, you know, this isn't attaching blame to anyone. It's just trying to show how the small, what seems like small things are really key decision points.
Well, you know, in defense of the first crew, you can imagine they get a lot of calls like this.
Yes.
And a lot of times people are having panic attacks,
right.
which is, you know, that happens a lot.
Right.
So, and if there's no signs indicating anything, because they ran all the tests and everything looked fine, but they always say, you know, but you can come to the hospital.
Right.
You should think about it. And they, you know, they were clear about that. So they didn't miss it. It was up to me. I made the choice not to go.
Right. Okay. That's fair. And the point here is not apportioning blame or pointing fingers at anyone. It's just how, what's the word I'm looking for? How chancy it can be in any of these encounters. One thing can make a huge difference either way, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's important. I think actually it's a good example of why we need social distancing, because hopefully today anyone who's got any sort of symptoms or even thinks they might have a problem really needs to isolate themselves for just this sort of reason. And even you, you know, we bring our own stuff, as we'll hear in a minute, we bring our own stuff to it, and you didn't even want the second crew to come because you're embarrassed for vanity reasons. Okay, so which we'll get into shortly. Okay, so that's the, at this point, that's part of the lesson for today, for today's COVID-19 issue, is this is what's the sort of thing that's going to happen. Right. And we all need to be alert. We need, you know, if you think you have symptoms, and even if you don't, you definitely need to be social isolating. One, doctors probably should err on the side of caution. Although here's the problem. If you all do that, the hospital is going to be completely overwhelmed, which is the problem right now. So that's that's another issue. And the other thing is, we ourselves may want to dismiss it, but we shouldn't. You know, you got to take it seriously. I'm reminded of a story that is sort of related. I was in a nasty car accident 4 years ago when someone veered across the line and smacked me head on. And I was so grateful that I, you know, I felt a little pain in my chest, but I was adrenalized after I came through. I was concussed for a few seconds when I came around. I thought, God, I'm alive. Thank God. And I got out and the EMS arrived and said, well, you know, that's a pretty nasty accident. You should come to the hospital. And I, do I? I mean, I really feel, he said, yeah, you should go. And it turned out I had a broken sternum and I'd been concussed. It was good. And I was talking about this to a doctor friend of mine sometime later, and he said there was a woman, similar thing happened to her that he knew, and she said, no, I'm fine, I'm busy, I've got lots to do, I'm fine. And she died later that day of an aneurysm. And so you've always got to err on the side of caution. You really do. You just don't know. It's easy to say, oh, I feel fine. I'm okay. Oh, I've got too much to do. Or, oh, I don't want people to see me like this or whatever it is. No, you've got to take the right, be as cautious as you need to be and recognize, hey, your life's at stake. Okay. Mm-hmm. So here you are, you're in an induced coma for 4 days, but you're not coming out of it. And this is where the story diverts into another area, perhaps. So tell us what happens next.
Well, while in the coma, I went through a series of very interesting, we're going to call them coma dreams. Mm-hmm. And you know, I guess I was hearing what was going on around me, but when you're in a coma, and I remember the first 4 days is induced, it's after that that when I wasn't induced, I stayed in a natural coma. But they couldn't figure out why I didn't come out of the coma. They sent me down for a CAT scan to discover that I had sustained a massive stroke, and it was in the front lobe, and they said she could either be a vegetable and or completely blind. So that was bad news to my family. And so, you know, at one point you wonder, do you keep a person on life support when the prognosis is so grim? Because now I could be a vegetable or blind or both. My heart was at a 10% ejection fraction. So for people who don't understand what that is, I mean, that's not sustainable. You can't have a life on that. And then my kidneys were in complete failure. So I was on dialysis. And I don't know, it was just so grim. What's the decision? Do you pull the plug or not? So my sister tells me that the doctors were preparing her to tell my 15-year-old son at the time that his mother was not going to survive. And but you know, interesting things started happening. And Carla says my eyelashes started to flutter, and they said, well, let's just hold off a little. And then there was positive signs, and they just kept waiting. And you know, after 2 weeks, I came out of the coma, which that in itself was a miracle, because I should have been on a heart transplant list, but one of the most amazing things happened to me while I was in the coma. I had been taken by an angel to what I call in God's waiting room. And I was told that my heart was that of a 98-year-old. It wasn't sustainable, and they were gonna bless me with a healed heart. They told me I would see differently when I come out of the coma. I had no idea what that meant, Howard. And that I was being sent back because it wasn't my time to go. I mean, if that doesn't say God's not in control, nothing does. They were giving me a second chance at life, and I would be doing mission work for God. So when I came out of the coma, one of the first doctors I saw was my cardiologist. And I said, "Doc, you wouldn't believe it. An angel took me. And this is what the angel said to me." And he said, "Oh, Barb, in all my years of being a cardiologist, I've never heard a story quite like this. But we're going to entertain that. Let's take you down, run some tests, and let's see if your angel story is right." And so at the end of the day, he comes back into my room with a big smile on his face. And he says, "Never in all my years of being a cardiologist have I ever seen anything like this. Indeed, this is a miracle. We could take your heart, in fact, and transplant it into someone who needed a heart transplant." And then my dialysis doctor, my nephrologist, I said, doc, because they were going to install another port. And I'm going, "You don't have to do that. I'm telling you, I've had miracles. I don't need dialysis anymore." And he said, "Barb, you will have dialysis for the rest of your life." I'm like, "No, I've had a miracle." So after installing the port, it wasn't a week later where they said, "You know what? Now we're going to uninstall it. You don't need it. That's truly a miracle too." So now I do see through different eyes. But that's a blessing in itself too. I say that God took my worldly view or my worldly vision and replaced it with a godly view, godly vision, a spiritual vision. It transformed my life from the inside out. That experience in God's waiting room was so powerful. From the moment I got out of the coma, I kept asking for, "Bring me a father, a preacher, a pastor, a chaplain." I couldn't get enough. And it's like being in the desert and being so thirsty. You want to dive into a watermelon because you're so thirsty. Like, give it to me. I just wanted to speak to any godly person to share my story, because what do you do with a story like that? You got to talk about it. So after I was released from the hospital, at the time, speech to text was done through a program called Dragon. And so I did have a lot of deficits. So one of the things I did was I recorded my story and all the coma dreams in a recorder, because I knew I had to share this story. I had to write this. This is, God didn't take me through this just to waste it. So in the 7 years of trying to write the book, a lot of transformation happened, because with every coma dream, and Howard, this is interesting, because by the time I met you, you helped me process a lot of these coma dreams, and you helped me see that, you know, when you're in a coma, your ability to process information on the conscious level, that filter is asleep. But your subconscious, which is to me the key, it holds all the trauma, it holds all the deep thoughts that have affected you over the years. That part is raw and vulnerable. So any stimulus that's around you, you don't now have the conscience to filter any of that. So it's amazing, you know, what the brain does with all that.
Absolutely. And you're exactly right. And people may not understand. They think in a coma, you're brain dead. But, you know, typically that is not the case. You can't relate to the outside world, but it's coming in and there is some processing going on, like your dream. And for example, you know, at the beginning when they were cardioverting you and needed, you know, keep doing that, your dream was of driving down a highway looking desperately for electricity. And you knew in this dream you had to find electricity. And, you know, it was just fascinating when you told me the dreams that you had, from my perspective, what that was about. And I think at the time you had written all this down, I think you had interpreted these dreams in terms of what was going on outside that you weren't able to process, like looking for electricity. But as we move through these coma dreams and stories, it seemed to me that there was something much, much, much more significant going on. And then as we talked about it and flushed that out, and then eventually we wrote the book, In God's Waiting Room, which is an amazing book. If you're really interested in the story, I really encourage you to try to get a copy of it. We go through all of what we've been talking about, and but specifically the coma dreams that Bob was having. And they, you know, when she woke up, she still had all of this in her head and wrote it down, and her a sister and a mom and Mike and various other people were there at different times. And it was interesting how she had incorporated, you know, some a visitor, for example, comes to see her. And she, at some level, knows who she is, but, you know, where does she fit into the story? And it's just fascinating how the brain in that reduced state, almost, put this together for you. And we concluded, in hindsight, of course, a lot easier when we know what happened in the end, we concluded in hindsight that there was a major spiritual change occurring in you.
Yeah. You know, when I talk about vanity, you know, I was thinking about this morning. Every young girl just wants to be beautiful. We want to be loved. We want to be cherished. We want to be appreciated. And, you know, when you think of the shows or programs for children like Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, these stories really affect the conscious and the thinking of a young girl. And we think that our only rescue is to find a knight in shining armor. And, you know, so goes the story of how, you know, little girls grow up to be women, but it's about beauty and being able to present ourselves as intelligent, successful, beautiful women. And if we don't have that, then what do we have to offer the world? And, you know, it becomes the beauty obsession where you lose focus really on what's important in life, which is having a relationship with God. And, you know, you don't even see how that can work in. Because you can't even see that. You're so obsessed with trying to make it and trying to be successful and trying to be beautiful. And it's not till you're brought down to your knees. It's not till you're on death's door. It's not till you have this ability to process at such a subconscious level all that has plagued me throughout most of my life. It was so freeing to finally understand that that's a false narrative. It's a story we tell ourselves. It's a story all women tell ourselves. And now you're seeing it, you know, in today's climate with such young girls, you know, at like 5 years old, they're starting, they have fingernail polish, their hair, makeup, and it's like, what the heck? You know, it's starting so young. I didn't start wearing makeup until well into later in life. You know, because when I was growing up in the 60s, you know, girls didn't dress like that. We had to be appropriate. But one of the most beautiful things that has ever happened to me in my life was the virus, because the way it showed up in my life, it allowed me to really have clarity on my identity. And my identity is not wrapped up in beauty. It's not wrapped up in who I am according to how the world views me. My identity is now in Jesus, and it's how Jesus sees me. And it's about love and serving and helping others find a relationship with Jesus. And I cannot tell you how freeing this is, Howard, how liberating. I feel like, and I am, I'm made new in Jesus. I feel like a whole new person. And, you know, it's like you just shed your skin and you put on your Jesus clothes and you don't have these concerns anymore like you used to. And, you know, I don't care if I'm not the most beautiful person in the world anymore. I've let go of that. Well, that is so freeing, especially now that I'm almost 60. Howard, I can't hear you.
There's a wonderful coma dream that is a metaphor for that, which is the tape. Do you want to tell the listeners about the tape?
Yeah, about the Barbie doll recordings?
Yes. So one of your dreams was...
Oh, boy. Yeah. You know, I think I'm just going to give you the fore story before I get into the dream. When I was 18 years old and attending Fanshawe College in London, Ontario, I remember being traumatized at that time that, you know, it's my first time away from home, and I really wanted to be really beautiful, and I really hadn't dated, and now I want to date, and there's all these competition with all these other girls that actually do wear makeup, and they dress, you know, more provocative, and, you know, coming from Mitchell, Ontario, Canada, you just don't dress like that. So this was, how do I become like the other girls? And, okay, so now in this dream, it's a, wow. There was a recording called the Barbie doll recordings. And I know we're going back into the 70s. A recording was actually a record. And I really wanted this record because if you listen to this record, it would magically transform you within 24 hours of listening to it. You would suddenly, over listening for 24 hours, you would have bigger breasts, you would be beautiful, long eyelashes, long, thick, gorgeous hair, tiny waist, nice buttocks, beautiful long legs. And then the best part of this is that it would actually change your attitude into one who really just commanded it. Like you could walk into a room and you could command yourself, and you would be so desirable. Every man would have you because you'd be so conceited that, you know, men want what they can't have. So my mom in my dream debated, now, should I send this to Barbie? Because she really wants to be beautiful. So she sends it to me. And then after she sent it, she's thinking, well, maybe I shouldn't have done that. But now it's too late because it's been set in motion. And so I received the recording. And in the middle of the record, there's crossbones and a skull. And it says, caution, you know, once you put this down, you will die a slow death in 24 hours. But I'm not looking at what the caution label is. I'm looking at the front of the album, which shows the most beautiful, like a Barbie doll, the most beautiful girl. And so I'm overriding all my senses by going, no, I don't care about that. It's like sin, Howard, you know. Mm-hmm. You know you're sinning, but you're going to do it because why? It's fun. Well, that's what you think until there's a consequence. So I put the album in place. I set the needle down, and immediately in a hissing tone, the record starts playing and saying, you know, I've basically sealed my fate. Now I'm going to have a long agonizing death. So in the next 24 hours, what happens every time the needle goes around the record, a ring of the vinyl comes off like a snake. So it's unwinding. And it's slow, and I'm on my bed, and I'm like trying to, oh boy, what have I done? It wraps around my ankle, and it keeps wrapping around my ankle until after 24 hours, the whole thing has unwound, and it snuffs my life out and kills me. And what's interesting about this is they had those, honey, what are those things called? The cuffs around the legs? The CV, honey? You know, those thrombosis ankle things that blow up to stop a stroke. And
compression socks.
So that felt like the record rings because they were so tight. And then because I could feel the sickness of being, I could barely breathe. And at the same time, I guess they were trying to take me off the ventilator. And I was like, huh, I can't get my air. So what I was actually feeling was the squeezing on my leg, but I was actually feeling them taking me off the ventilator where I couldn't breathe. I was 100% sure I was dead. And then in my next dream, I'm now in a dumpster. And now I hear the morning news talking about my life and what a waste. I'm just this discarded college student who again contracted this deadly virus of the record ring virus. It's like the virus of sin. And my life had no value, no worth, because being found dead, discarded dead in a dumpster beside a drunk, an old drunk, and everybody was laughing at me, and the cops were making fun of me, like, oh, this old drunk have his way with her. And I'm like, I'm dead now, Howard, I'm dead. How do I tell everybody that this isn't the truth? It's not the truth. I wasn't out having my way with some drunk and then he killed me. That's not the truth. And then I realized in my coma, wow, what have I done? What, my life is empty. People view me as this young college girl who didn't have enough sense to not get into trouble, and this is their own fault. And there was no legacy I left except this college girl who her vanity got the best of her. Wow. And then the next scene, I'm on the embalming table. And I hear my sister, because she's doing my eyebrows, trying to make me look beautiful. And in reality, that's what was going on. She was doing my eyebrows and trying to make me look beautiful. But I'm thinking, well, they're preparing me for the funeral. And I could hear Mike, I could hear Carla, I could hear Dino. And then at that point, I guess they left the room. And again, they turned the ventilator off and I couldn't breathe. And I thought, well, if I wasn't dead before, I'm certainly dead now. But you know, Howard, that's when I realized I wasn't dead. Because if I was gasping for air, I'm actually not dead.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, perhaps people have now understood what is going on. You go through a number of other sequences. Not long after that, you have this encounter with an angel who tells you you will see through different eyes and your heart will be healed. You wake up 7 days about that later and find out indeed you are seeing differently because you've had a stroke, but your heart is now one of a 20-year-old somehow, whereas 2 weeks before you needed a heart transplant and it was only worth 10%. Obviously, that had a major impact on you. So let's talk in the last few minutes. We have 10 minutes or so. Let's talk about how that has changed your life.
So now I understand a lot about how the brain works and about the stories that we tell ourselves. And I do mission work now, and I use the horses. I work with an organization called Agape. It's a treatment center for women of addiction, mental health, and human trafficking. And the women that come through Seahorse Miami, which is the program that we have, a big part of it is we talk a lot about the brain and how the brain is a storyteller. And, you know, we all have stories from that relate back to when we were young, because I think with just about every single person, all our early traumas start then, and it's the stories we tell ourselves going through, you know, adolescence into adulthood. And the beautiful thing is we can change our narrative. That's a story that we keep confirming to ourselves. But Jesus says that we can take all these thoughts captive and we can be made new in Him. That does not have to be the story. And so through using the horses led by the Holy Spirit, we're able to do a type of therapy that really is, it's quite incredible because it helps reveal the hidden issues, or, you know, it could be their gifts and talents. And then we can sort of dive into that, but it's watching the interaction between the ladies and the horse that we're able to ask questions. And, you know, I say God created horses for this. In 3 seconds or less, a horse gets your number, because in the wild, to stay safe, they have to be able to size up a situation very quickly. So they either run for the hills, they run in circle and come back, or they stay put. But when the women come in, it's amazing how immediately the horse starts responding to what's going on in the lady. And I've never seen anything like it. I don't think they have either, but it's very effective. But we have a whole half an hour after that on talking about what we're talking about. And that is simply how they don't have to be stuck in their situations. So I've learned that we can all have a new life. We can all learn that our brain is simply a storyteller at the best of times. And anytime even my thoughts go negative, like with what's going on right now with the corona, I go, wait, I'm going to take that thought captive and I'm going to replace it with something like, who does God say I am in him? Or I'll go into some scripture. And did you know that every time you read scripture, you're blessed? But it's not just when you read scripture, it's when you really get and you have positive thoughts about it. Did you know the brain actually fires it produces more branches on the tree in your brain? What is that called? It fires the synapses?
Neurons and and pathways.
Yes, and when you think negatively and you live in fear, what happens is the brain does the opposite. It actually starts to shrink up, all the branches shrink up, but it also affects your health. So it's really important to take every thought captive because you don't want a brain that's shrinking and it's affecting your immune system either.
Yeah. And so it's... Yeah, absolutely. Lots of interesting things there. Candace Pert, who was a very well-known female scientist in a very male institution, wrote a wonderful book called Molecules of Emotion about how almost every activity thought is passed through the body in some way into different cells. And she has a great line, which is, your body is your subconscious. In other words, that stuff is held there. And I think that's very compelling. And since she wrote that, it was probably 25 years ago, and there's quite a lot of work that suggests that's actually what is happening. And then in my book, I Think Therefore I'm Wrong, which, looks at the fact that we are storytellers first and foremost, I make the point that actually virtue is the basis of wisdom. Virtue is the basis of wisdom. And there is now neuroscientific evidence to suggest that's true. People who practice gratitude, mercy, forgiveness, actually shape that, have a prefrontal cortex that allows them not to get impulsively caught up in the emotion, not to instantly react to everything, but the ability to stand back and look at their thinking, look at what's going on. And that, I do believe, is the basis of wisdom. I do think virtue is the basis of wisdom. So you have, your story is really incredible. I've written lots of books, but it is certainly the most incredible one in terms of a transformation that I have heard about. And I've heard a few good ones for sure. Tell people about where they can find any information about, like, Seahorse Miami and what you're doing.
So they can go to www.seahorsemiami.org. Now, C isn't spelled S-E-A, it is spelled S-E-E. That stands for my vision, because I see differently. Or it can also be seeing God at work.
Right.
So again, www.seahorsemiami.org. And also the book that Howard and I wrote, you can go to www.ingodswaitingroom.net. And there's no apostrophe between the D and the S in God's. So again, ingodswaitingroom.net. And so, currently we are trying to expand the program to reach more women. So if anybody wants to make a donation, they can do it on seahorsemiami.org. As a matter of fact, I just got another one this morning, a donation from a chaplain who is sowing seed into the program. But you know, the one thing I can honestly say that the best thing that ever happened to me, besides meeting Mike and having my children, is contracting the H1N1 virus. And I think that people need to view this virus outbreak as taking joy. And it's said in scripture, and I can't remember which one it is. I think it's in Romans. It's about taking the joy, because Paul went through so much adversity that in adversity, we find joy because we know God is at work. And this is to draw us into a relationship with God. And right now, he has all of us on our knees. And we shouldn't waste this moment. This is for us to come to him and see he's in control of everything, Howard. He allowed this to happen. He allows everything to happen, the stock market, everything. It's all in his control. And the sooner we can see this, and the sooner we can repent, and the sooner we know who's in control, you know, the better off we are, the more we find joy and peace. And I got to tell you, in times like this, peace is a hot commodity, because all the other commodities, they're fake. Real peace that comes from knowing the Lord, faith and trust, that's the hottest commodity going, and you can't buy it.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the message there is also at times of adversity, that's when you can learn a lot about yourself, about other people, but mostly about yourself and purpose. And, you know, there's a great quote, and I forget who it's from, so I can't claim it to be mine, but it's, God allows you to reach rock bottom so you can discover that he is the rock at the bottom, right?
Yes.
And these are trying times, but your story, both in terms of the sort of worldly aspect of how you contracted it and went through it, but also the spiritual aspect of it, is just, I think, very, very appropriate. So thank you for sharing that. Seahorsemiami.org, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, Howard, I want to say one more thing. One of the sessions we do at Seahorse Miami is one of my favorite. It's about surrender. What does surrender look like? And right now we have the whole world in surrender position. Again, don't waste it. So what we do is we have the ladies take the horse and we say, okay, we want you to ask the horse to lay down. Now, for a horse to lay down to surrender, okay, that's like next to impossible for a horse to lay down and surrender. Because when a horse lays down, a switch goes off in the head and they actually, it's like they go out kind of. Because in the wild, if a predator takes them down, and you'll see it when you watch, you know, National Geographic, like the zebra will just like lay still. And I think when that happens, it shuts down all the nerves so it doesn't feel. So a horse will do the same thing. So a horse refuses to lay down because he knows once he's down, that's it. And I asked the ladies, well, tell me about what surrender looks like in your life. And they all say it's the hardest thing to do. There's fake surrender, which most of us do, but what is real surrender? So I give them a little toolkit, which is a hobble and a rope, and I say, go to it. One represents prayer, the other one represents the Bible, and it's fun to watch the women trying to get this horse down to the ground. And then eventually they just say, can you just lay down? And the horse just flops down like a fish. And then they have a little can of blessings, which is treats. You know, the horse knows the drill, Howard.
Right.
Then the whole point is, once we go into full surrender, then the blessings really start. So the women go over and they start giving the horse the blessings, because he's, you know, this is to represent how God works in our life when we can fully surrender.
Right.
The blessings come like tenfold. And I know it is the hardest thing to surrender your will, but it's truly, that's how God can work in our lives.
Yep. And we are asking people at this time, aren't they, to surrender what they normally do, et cetera, et cetera. And that comes with a lot of anxiety for people, and I totally understand that. But it's amazing often what happens when you find yourself in that position, and that's what you do. And you're sort of a great example of that. So thank you again, Bob, for sharing the story. Again, In God's Waiting Room, if you really want to read the whole story. And again, thank you so much for sharing. And I know that is important for you because you realize the significance of what happened to you.
Yeah. Howard, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to be on your amazing show, that we can reach people and share, you know, this information. It's so critical, especially at this time.
Absolutely. Well, God bless. And we'll talk again soon. Take care. Yeah.